dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva or WXXE Fenner, Syracuse. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. During the 1972 presidential election campaign, the Watergate scandal broke into the press. Two reporters from the Washington Post, Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein, followed a story of a burglary at the Democratic headquarters that exposed a conspiracy that led all the way to the Nixon White House. Nixon ultimately resigned to avoid impeachment. This story of the free press keeping government honest has been held up as evidence that the system works. The reality is that the press is rarely a watchdog of the public interest, and is increasingly less so due to its subordination to the financial interests of its owners. Tonight, we're going to hear from Professor Robert McChesney speaking on Rich Media, Poor Democracy. Then, a report on the efforts to neutralize the last remaining independent radio network, Pacifica Radio, and a talk by Democracy Now! Host Amy Goodman on the state of journalism today. Robert McChesney is a research professor at the Institute of Communications Research at the University of Illinois. He's the author of Telecommunications, Mass Media, and Democracy, The Battle for the Control of U.S. Broadcasting, Rich Media, Poor Democracy, and most recently, It's the Media, Stupid. He spoke in New York City on November 8th.
Right before this talk, I was talking to a newspaper reporter who wanted to talk about the book, and we ended up talking for an hour and a half about the election. I think that's probably how it is for a lot of people today, that whatever you start talking about, you end up on the election pretty quickly and stay there for a while. I had gone to bed last night in Madison, seeing the Nader totals pummeled all over the country, about half of what we expected from the polls the day before, saying, well, at least they won't blame Nader for this one. And then I came to New York to discover, no, indeed, evidence is not necessary in the pursuit of a good argument. We'll talk about the election more later. Let's talk a little bit about this book. I think I owe it to the publisher who arranged this to give you a summary of what the book is, what it's about. And then we'll go into some of the political issues that come out of the book. The title of the book, Rich Media, Poor Democracy, is to suggest a paradox. I mean, in traditional political theory, the idea would be if the government doesn't censor the content of media directly, if basically anyone can start media they want in a commercial marketplace, the theory is that you'll have the best possible marketplace of ideas, a flowering world, which ideas will compete with each other and we'll all live happily ever after. We'll have rich media and rich democracy. Instead, though, as we look at the United States today, we see a booming media sector, corporate communication sector, but a shriveling and dilapidated political culture. And so what I attempt to address in this book is that paradox, that conflict between this booming, rich corporate media culture. The average American now spends 11 and a half hours a day consuming media, one form or another. It's up considerably from just 10 years ago. And at the same time, our very weak, depraved political culture, which I think, when you look closely at it, and I'll talk about it more later, by traditional democratic criteria, it really stretches the use of the terms democratic when you're describing our society today. Well, what are the main trends I talk about in the book? In terms of media, there are two things I look at some length as the nature of the media industries themselves, the increase in concentration of ownership and the rise of conglomeration. This is something I suspect all of you know a little bit about, or you wouldn't be here. In the past generation, there's been a stunning consolidation of ownership in our media and communications industries. Ben Bagdikian wrote a classic book in 1983 called The Media Monopoly, And in that book, Bagdikian said there were 50 companies now that basically owned all the media in the United States, or the lion's share of them. And this was an outrage at the time, a shock. You know, how could only 50 companies? It looks like we have thousands of radio stations and book publishers and magazines and newspapers, yet only 50 companies basically own all this stuff. And since then, though, Bagdikian has done, I think, 6 editions now. In the most recent edition, I think he's got it down to like 10 due to mergers and acquisitions. And by my calculations, I think we're looking at a situation in the United States today where there are roughly 7 or 8 super conglomerates that are the first tier of media in the United States and the world. It's a global system. I'll talk about that more in a second. And then there's a second tier of about 15 or so companies that round out the system. And once you get past about 22 or 23 companies, you're really in the Bush leagues. I mean, that first tier of 7 or 8 companies owns all the TV networks, owns all the movie studios, 4 of the 5 music companies that sell 80 or 85% of the music in the world and 90% of the music in the United States, almost all the main TV stations in the 10 largest markets in the country, a significant percentage of the book and magazine publishing. That's just the first 7 or 8 companies. They own all or in part all the cable TV channels you watch, all the commercial ones. So that's just the first ones. And then the last 15 that round out the system on all the newspaper chains and the remaining cable systems, what's left over, basically. And that's a very small group of companies that dominate our media system. And by any traditional liberal democratic theory, even if these were the 24 or 20 most magnanimous individuals on earth who were the CEOs of these companies, this would be cause for concern, because these are largely non-competitive markets in traditional economic sense. If you wanted to start a film studio, for example, or a TV network, or to have access to the sort of audience these firms have, it's impossible. The best evidence of how difficult it is why AOL paid $100 billion to buy Time Warner. They could have physically recreated the assets of Time Warner for probably $10 or $15 billion. They could have built the same studios and buildings and produced all the same stuff. But that's not what they wanted. They wanted to buy into these closed-off markets. They wanted to buy their chunk of the media market, the television market, the cable market. That's why the price was so high, because that's what these companies have, are semi-monopolistic control over markets. In addition to concentration, fewer and fewer owners, the corresponding part of that is what I call conglomeration. And that means that the dominant media companies, as I just pointed out, the largest 7 or 8, don't just do one thing anymore. I mean, they do lots of things. Time Warner, for example, is a major film studio. It has a TV network. It's the second largest cable company in the United States. It has the most cable channels by far. It's the largest magazine publisher in the United States. It's one of the largest book publishers. It owns sports teams. It has retail stores. It's the largest music company in the United States. I mean, they're conglomerates. And what the logic of the media market has proven in the last 10 or 20 years is that the profit hole for a conglomerate is vastly greater than the sum of the profit parts. That's why you can't compete now unless you're part of a conglomerate. You aren't going to see an independent music company or film company or TV network. If you're not part of a conglomerate, you simply are at a competitive disadvantage that you can't survive. That's why the conglomerate model now rules the entirety of our media system, which really accentuates concentration and makes the companies bigger and bigger and bigger. This is only going to get worse, by the way. The speed with which it gets worse will depend on what happens in Florida in the next day. Al Gore is terrible on these issues, as I'm going to talk about in a second. George W. Bush is unbelievably bad. I mean, his policy basically is to get rid of any remaining ownership regulations, let consolidation proceed as quickly as possible. And if he gets his way, the numbers I'm using here will be out of date within a year, and there'll be dramatically fewer companies that own our media system. Now, I argue that this sort of concentration and conglomeration in the book really produces several problems for a society, especially a society that claims to be democratic and free. One of them is hyper-commercialism, the commercialization of every nanosecond of our lives, of every square inch of our space. The market power these conglomerates have, the lack of direct competition, makes it vastly easier for them to hyper-commercialize everything, not just with advertising, but with product placement, as they move to the web increasingly, with linking product sales to the actual editorial content, basically turning the line between the editorial or the creative and the commercial, which used to be a fairly understandable line to a person in our society, increasingly disintegrating. What I argue are very negative implications for the quality of media content, and I go into some detail in that in the book. I spent a lot of time talking about journalism. It's a very great interest of mine. It's probably the most important media content in my mind. It's what I'm most concerned with. And I don't hold the view that concentrated media ownership and conglomeration is the only thing that influences the nature of journalism in our society today. I think it's one of the three major factors that have to be taken into consideration. The other two would be just the traditional concern you have in any media system of how the owner influences the content or the advertisers, the sort of institutional pressure. And that applies not only in a commercial media system, but in a state system, like a communist system or in a public broadcasting system, how the owner or the person in charge influences the content, how they directly go. And in media, in journalism, that manifests itself most directly, like the owner of a newspaper goes into the editorial office and says, don't cover that story because that's a friend of mine. That sort of intervention, or cover that story, that person just bought an ad, want to give them some good treatment. That's fairly common, but it's not all that common. I mean, it's getting more common, but that used to be standard operating procedure in American newspapers in the 19th century. And it became a real crisis in this country 100 years ago, when newspapers became more and more concentrated, only one or two in a market. They have such patently partisan journalism, serving the interest of owners, simply didn't cut it. And that's when we saw the rise of professional journalism. The idea that the journalism was neutral, it was objective, it wasn't influenced by the owners or advertisers. So if you picked up a newspaper owned by person A or newspaper owned by person C, the editorial account would be roughly the same because it's put up by the same trained professional journalists. Professional journalism has a good reputation in our culture. It's held in high regard as upgrading the quality of journalism. I think a closer look shows that it has serious problems for a democratic society as well. And I've written about those at some length. But it tends to make it the journalism far more the reporting of those in power and letting those in power to dictate the terms of the reporting to follow professional standards. And I can go into that more later if people want to talk about it, but I'll leave it there for now. What I do want to talk about, though, specifically is the commercial pressure in the last 15 years to what's happened to journalism. As we've seen newspaper chains, broadcast journalists increasingly become part of these huge conglomerates, as we've seen the concentration of ownership, what has happened to journalism? Well, what's happened is several things, but a couple worth taking into consideration, is that what we've discovered is good journalism tends to be very bad for business, and bad journalism, regrettably, tends to be quite good for business. And think about what we want from journalism in a democratic society. You usually want two things in a democracy. What you want from journalism is you want it to provide, first of all, a rigorous and ruthless accounting of people in power and people who want to be in power. Who's in power, what they're up to, people who want to replace them, what they're up to. So as a citizen, you can actually know what's going on. The second thing you want from journalism is an accurate presentation of facts and opinions on the most important social issues of the day. So you can sort of weigh an issue, come to an opinion, and govern your own life, self-government. If you have those two things, you've got a pretty healthy journalism. Well, those two things make for very bad business. So we have very little of that in our journalism today, precious little of that. Investigative journalism hardly exists anymore in any meaningful sense. Not that it was ever great, but it's simply investigative journalism, if you think about it, is not very smart. It costs a lot of money to do investigative journalism. You have to take skilled reporters, give them a lot of time and resources to do a story. The same reporters, or even less competent reporters, could fill your news hole day after day with press releases, stories about celebrities, trivia like that. So business-wise, it's not such a smart move. And the worst thing of all for investigative journalism is that it actually might come up with a good story. And then you're doing a hard story on some powerful institution, and that's not good business either. That's very bad business for commercial media. We see this most starkly today in the coverage of the relationship of the media giants to the Chinese government, where in every case we've seen them back down from hard journalism to placate that government to get access to that market. It's simply something you understand. Business needs come first over journalist priorities. The other sort of strong commercial pressure that's arisen in the last 15 years in our journalism relates to more and more turning the news product into business news, aiming it more and more at the middle class and the upper class, and writing off the bottom third of the population almost entirely as not being participants in our society. You see that in newspapers quite starkly today. Most daily newspapers in the United States have written off the bottom third of the cities that they live in. Chicago, which I live near now, if you go to Chicago and you go into the south or west side, there are large sections of the city you'd have a hard time finding a Chicago Tribune. But if you were to go up to New Trier or whatever that place is, Mark, you know, Winnetka, I mean, you're tripping over the Chicago Tribune. Because those are the people they want to have reading the Chicago Tribune. I'm sure the same thing in the New York Times. I have no doubt in the South Bronx and New Rochelle, for example, to use the same comparison, or the Upper West Side and Bed-Stuy. And what you have then is a journalism that's shaped increasingly to the needs and prejudices of the middle class and the upper middle class. And what we've seen in the last 10 or 15 years, is it makes perfect sense business-wise, is a morphing of traditional news of business news. On the cable news channels, the two have almost become interchanged now. And last night, it was almost an Orwellian experience to watch CNBC during the election tallies, because they were running the stock quotes on the, you didn't even see this, they were running the stock quotes at the bottom. And then where they normally have the NASDAQ and the Dow Jones scores, they had Bush and Gore. And my wife said, that's perfect, that says it all. That really lays out what this is all about here. But you just see this morphing of business news with real news, or with public news, with news for citizens. To give some example of how this manifests itself. I mean, so the best journalism is aimed at the business class. I mean, if you want to see good journalism, read the Financial Times, Business Week, or the Wall Street Journal. Don't read the editorial page of the Wall Street Journal. But the rest of it's pretty good journalism, because that's who it's aimed at. But if you look at CNN or MSNBC, you know, they act like the effects of the stock market and buying computers and trips to Europe are something all Americans engage in. That's just every person now is participating in that world. When in fact that world drops out at least half our population, in any really honest sense of the term, drops out the bottom three quarters of our population, if not more in certain cases. But look at some of the stories you then see in this new world of commercial journalism and how they're covered, how this bias manifests itself, especially this class bias. John F. Kennedy Jr., remember when he died? And who can forget him? I mean, that's one of these events that, like, people who remember the Kennedy session, you remember where you were when you heard that John F. Kennedy Jr.'s plane went down. It's of that sort of importance. Everyone here can remember where they were when they heard about John F. Kennedy's plane going down. And a private citizen. I mean, hey, Jeff. Jeff Komen, the founder of Fairness in Action Reporting, has joined us, everyone. Yeah really. Yeah, so what was the press coverage like of the JFK Jr. story? Well, if you remember, I hope you don't, for like 10 days, they turned our televisions into virtual aquariums. Around the clock coverage of this on the Fox News Channel, I think they basically cut off all other stories until the funeral. Think about that. I mean, how absurd that was. Now consider 4 months later in Seattle, just about a year ago, 50,000 people from all over the United States, indeed the world, came together to protest the World Trade Organization meeting. Now, for years, journalists had said, well, we can't cover globalization and what it means for labor and the environment and women and workers and all that sort of stuff because there's no news peg. It'll look like we're pushing our own agenda if we start covering these stories. You know, so we have to lay off that. Unless legitimate sources debate it, we can't cover it without looking like we've got an axe to grind. It wouldn't be professional. Well, here was the news peg. Here, finally, was the chance for working journalists to say, okay, now we've got this amazing demonstration, our Tiananmen Square, in fact, going on in this country. Now we can give it the treatment it deserves. And let's compare the coverage to JFK Jr., that crucial story that took place 4 months earlier. No special break-in around-the-clock coverage, none whatsoever. In fact, there were very few special reports, if any, that was basically covered in the normal news slot, even on these cable news channels, and they're desperate to fill time. And some of you might have heard the story because I tell it a lot and it's in some of the stuff I've written, but it bears worth repeating. A friend of mine, John Nichols, who I wrote a little pamphlet with called It's the Media Stupid, and John writes for The Nation, was covering the WTO demonstrations in Seattle last year. And I was at home in Madison, and he called me up on, I think it was Wednesday night, and it was a night of a massive demonstration. It was like 5 o'clock in Seattle. And he said, Bob, you are not going to believe it. I've never seen anything like this. This is the greatest demonstration in 30 years. The wisdom of these kids, the combinations, the alliances, this is the most amazing political story I've ever seen with my career as a political reporter. And I said, oh, this is great. I've got to crank on the TV. And, you know, this is a hot story. And he held up his phone, and you hear this roar of the crowd. I mean, it's like it's amazing, like a tidal wave. So I turn on the TV. I go to CNN. Larry King's on. I think he's talking to Arnold Schwarzenegger. I said, well, this is an important new movie coming out, probably. So I turned it over to the Fox News Channel. That's quite a channel you work for, Jeff. And they had one of those things with the big letters and the classical music, breaking story, you know, thump, 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 breaking story. I'm getting really excited. This is hot, breaking story, finally. And they show a guy in a trench coat, and it's wet. It's dark out. So it's got to be Seattle. So then, and I'm not making this up. I couldn't make this up. I honestly, if I tried, you wouldn't. It's just too incredible. So yeah, we're going to this breaking story. And they go to this guy, and he says, here we are in Atlanta, and the parents of JonBenet Ramsey have just been spotted going into that restaurant, you know, to meet with their publicist. I can't say any more. I'll just leave it there. I think, you know, we've said all. But there's a reason for this. There's a reason for why things like the WTO get left out. Many reasons, but they're also related to the way the media industries work. First of all, the media industries are the primary recipients of things like the WTO. They're globalizing. They're expanding. Their revenues shoot up when these deals go through. They are not unbiased observers of globalization. In fact, globalization, as we know, would be impossible without global commercial media. The two go hand in hand. They're not unrelated. In fact, they're directly related. So they have a stake in the outcome here. Second, consider the sources of journalism. The sources, who covers the WTO story? It's the Business Reporter. Who are the sources they use for their stories? They're business sources. And the business sources who've been trained in this mythology of Milton Friedman's free market with a lot of heroic entrepreneurs running around competing, globalization seems perfectly wonderful, normal. To oppose it means being in the flat earth society. It's, you know, so all the sources are saying this globalization's great, these guys must be wacky. So the journalists are really in a hard spot, I mean, to come up with critical stuff given the nature of the sources they're working with. And the coverage was appropriately then dreadful. One other issue, and I told... No, absolutely, there was some wonderful indie media, and that's exactly where you develop your critique, is you have a chance to see people post stuff or talk to people who've been there, and then you can compare it to what you're getting. And that's exactly right. That's where a whole generation of media activists is being born, precisely on that conflict between what you're experiencing and what you're seeing and the stuff that's being dished out on CNBC and Fox News and in the New York Times. One other issue, though, and then I'll move on to the book, but to give another example, and I talk about this in the preface to the paper edition, the class bias is one of the great stories that, of course, neither Gore nor Bush had any interest in discussing in this election. I mean, I guess it's not that important, which is the rise of the prison industrial complex in this country in the last 15 years, which is one of the most extraordinary stories of my lifetime. It's one of the two or three great stories of our age. It's the, what, tripling, is it now, in the number of prisoners in this country in the last 15 years? We have 5% of the world's population and 25% of the world's prisoners. The rate of increase is staggering. I think within 5 or 10 years we'll be approaching, if not surpassing, Hitler and Stalin for percentage of the population behind bars. It's a truly incredible story. I mean, that's only begins to get at the problem. I mean, a lot of these are people who are victims of the drug war for nonviolent offenses. 90% of the prisoners are in for nonviolent offenses. And, you know, what we know about it, and most of the stuff's come out in books published by presses like the New Press and Seven Stories and Common Courage and Monthly Review. What we know about it is that, you know, a significant percentage of people behind bars are actually innocent. You know, Barry Scheck, the guy from the OJ Trials Innocent Project, has shown extraordinary amount of evidence on the degree of misapprehension and conviction of people behind bars. It's an astonishing story. Doesn't get a whole lot of play. I mean, in Illinois, which is my neighboring state, and I teach there now, more people have been exonerated, as I'm sure all of you know, or should know, on death row and let go free than have actually been executed. Even the Republican governor of Illinois, who loves the death penalty, said, I'm not going to execute any more people until, you know, we get this thing figured out. I've probably murdered a couple, you know, already, and that's enough, you know. And that goes on and on. The class bias of our criminal justice system as well, where the guy in Texas, he stole a Snickers bar. Now, granted, it was an extra large Snickers bar, apparently. Got 16 years in prison. In the exact same month, four executives at the largest vitamin company in the world were, in what the U.S. Justice Department called the worst case of criminal antitrust they'd dealt with, corporate antitrust, with price fixing that gouged literally hundreds of millions of dollars out of consumers on vitamins. Were given fines of up to $150,000 and prison sentences of 3 to 4 months. You know, there's this class bias there. So all this put together, it's a dreadful situation. But you won't read much about it in the news media. Basically, in our news media, the coverage of crime is the sort of Gore Bush coverage. So there's a lot of tough talk about getting tough on criminals, three strikes, you're out, build some more prisons, but nothing about the reality of this experience and the heavy racial and racist overtones of the prison industrial complex as well. And I think there's no mistake about this. Who are the prisoners? They're from the bottom 25% of the population almost entirely, with only a handful of exceptions in terms of socioeconomic background. They're, in fact, from the part of the population the commercial news media is totally uninterested in. It's completely written off. They don't care if they read them or watch them. Their advertisers don't care. The other viewers and listeners don't want to be near them. They simply don't count. So they're not subject of news. Now imagine if that same the prison population came exclusively from graduates of Ivy League universities, places like the University of Illinois, not poor families. Would it be a news story then? Well, it'd be the biggest news story you've ever been through. I mean, it wouldn't happen. It would be impossible. I mean, the class bias, we just take, it just seems natural that you have this bias built in. But it's gotten worse. And it's gotten worse along with the sort of the increased amount of inequality in our society that basically has created a large section of the population that's not a viable player in the commercial news media system. And the book, it's a long book, by the way, and I'm just, you know, I'm about halfway through the first chapter, and there's another 350 pages to go, but I'll go very quickly through the balance of it. The second chapter is all about the relationship of the emerging global commercial media system and globalization. As I said before, it's a very necessary relationship. I also go into an addition chapter in the decline of what's called public service broadcasting worldwide. Public service broadcasting is something we've never had in the United States, so you're permitted and have no idea what I'm talking about. It refers to nonprofit and non-commercial broadcasting aimed at the entire population, providing not just boring educational shows and journalism, but also entertainment shows as well, without any ads on them. And if you go to other countries that have public broadcasting, they actually have like funny shows on them and sports without any ads. That's what public broadcasting is. That's under severe attack by the global commercial media system, saying, like they say, like, they want a system in the United States. You guys only do the stuff that no one wants to watch, that you can't make any money off of, and then go beg to get some money from government or wealthy viewers. And that's unfortunately becoming the pattern around the world. The great public systems are under attack. They're sort of a square peg in the round hole of global commercial media. And it's one of the big fights that's going on around the world. The longest chapter in the book, and I think in many ways the most important, deals with the internet. Since the rise of the internet, and especially the World Wide Web in the early 90s, there's been a lot of hype. You all know that. Basically, I think the classic line came from John Harry or Perry Barlow, the guy who wrote lyrics for the Grateful Dead, and now sort of fancied himself into sort of internet impresario, said that we don't have to worry about media consolidation, all these big companies getting bigger and bigger, because, you know, they're just rearranging deck chairs in the Titanic. When the internet comes along, that internet iceberg with 500 billion channels, and who's going to care about NBC or the New York Times or Gannett or Rupert Murdoch? Now, they'll just go away like the dodo birds. They're going to crash and die because there'll be so many choices. Those big media giants are soon to be dead. And that, ironically, is the logic that's used today by Time Warner and AOL, by Viacom and CBS when they do mergers. They say, gee, the internet's coming with all this new competition. You got to get us really big now so we can crush it when it comes. Yeah.
I work in the internet industry, I'm a systems administrator, and have been working in this industry for 6 years. It's kind of funny that they view the internet as being this great democratic medium, but in the 6 years that I've been working in the industry, there are backbone providers which provided network connections between computers all over the world. When I started, there were probably 30 backbone providers in the country. There are now two, AT&T and WorldNet and Sprint. Those three control a good 90% of the backbone networks. So the same companies that own the media channels own the networks, which all the internet data has to go over. So they don't want something to be routed through their networks, they can turn it off.
Well, it's even worse than that. That's true, but I mean, it's much worse than that. I mean, the claims about media with the internet were simply this, and it makes a certain amount of sense if you think about it. Anyone can start a website for not a great deal of money. Anyone can access it anywhere in the world. It's not too difficult. You can type in the proper letters or symbols. So in that case, all websites are created equal, more or less. NBC's and Rupert Murdoch's are the same as mine or yours. And if there are 500 million out there, well, then that sort of old monopoly that those companies had over our attention is gone. And they're not going to win anymore. Who's going to care about Rupert Murdoch once he can see my website or any of yours? Well, we've had 7 years of experience to show that's not going to happen. It's not going to happen at all. If anything, you can make the argument the internet is speeding up consolidation in a host of industries, including media. And it's not going to happen for very obvious reasons. That argument was premised in the idea that the reason we have concentration in our media system today is due to technology. The reason we have it is because of technology. It's not due to technology. It's due to markets. It's due to capitalism that we have concentration. And what we've discovered is that just having the ability to start a website doesn't amount to a hill of beans in the big scheme of things. And what I'm talking about here is making commercially viable websites. Any of us can start a website. I've got one. You know, like 3 people visit it a month. It's probably some of you have websites too. But what I find is commercially viable. I mean, you can make money on it, pay your bills, hire people, do it full time. I mean, like NBC does TV, or Rupert Murdoch makes movies at Fox, that sort of thing. Or Rupert Murdoch's people do. He does it, obviously. And there, the track record is good. No one's been able to make it. And the existing media giants, I go through this in some detail, have tremendous advantages. And I get all my sources here, and for much of the book, from the business press, from Wall Street. This is not from, like, the Albanian People's Party newspaper. The reasons are real clear. It's why you couldn't raise a nickel today for an IPO to do a media content site on the internet. I mean, you couldn't even get past the intern at the front desk if you tried to raise money to do that today, because it's a sure loser. No one can do it. I'll go very quickly through the reasons. The book has it in great detail. Existing media giants already have digital content. You'd have to start it to compete with them. That gives them a tremendous advantage. They've got brand names people know. You'd have to actually create brand names and type them so people know them. Most importantly, they can bring over their existing media users from their existing websites to their, some of their existing media, like their magazines, cable channels, to their web activities. And this is crucially important because, you know, if you don't, you know, if you've got a website, you've got to have people know about it. You have to pay a fortune to advertise to have any hope of survival. That's why ad budgets went up for TV so much in the last couple of years, ad revenues. Well, if you already are a media company, you don't have to pay all that money. It's cheaper. You can just run it and plug it into your scheduled promos, constant promos of your web activities. Moreover, the existing media giants have spectacular advantages in negotiating pole position with portals, web browsers, software companies. Now, if you type in New York Knicks on your search engine, probably in the first page you're going to get the CNNSI, the Time Warner New York Knicks page. You're going to get the MSNBC, Microsoft, General Electric page. You're going to get Rupert Murdoch's Fox News channel. You're going to get Disney's ESPN. You know, there might be someone in this room who knows more about the New York Knicks than any of those hired hands of those companies. You might have a great website, but it'll probably show up on page 892. And how many people have the time to go to page 892 to find that website? You do? Okay. Yeah, those are the portals. And actually, right now, it's similar to the argument this gentleman made. Well, yes and no. I mean, I agree and I disagree. I agree in the sense that when a new technology comes around, like the internet, it creates a new economic revolution, and new companies are born, just like with the computer industry. And you have then a winnowing down to a handful that dominate, and no one else can enter the industry, which is happening very quickly now on the internet. We're really down to 3 viable portals now, according to Wall Street, that anyone could raise money for. Microsoft, AOL, and Yahoo. All the others are merging. They're having trouble surviving. But those aren't media companies in the sense I'm talking about. I'm talking about people actually say, okay, I couldn't get into the film industry or the TV industry or the music industry. I'm going to go online, and I'm going to produce content and make money at it, and commercial, increase the amount of competition in existing media industries. My argument deals specifically with that, not that other stuff. My argument says looking at the internet that way, as this technological foundation of all sorts of new competition that will challenge the status quo, the evidence is clear. No one's making money doing that. There's no reason to think they will. To the extent the internet becomes part of our media system, as it quickly is, it's going to be dominated by the same people who dominate the balance of our media system. That's my argument, and I think the evidence bears that out. I'm welcome to hear someone tell me about some big movie company making a fortune on the internet I haven't heard of, but I doubt it. But it's a very important argument, because right now, the argument you're going to hear, the next media deal that comes down, just like the last 4, is we have to get rid of all barriers on mergers and let these companies get bigger and bigger, because all this great new competition that's coming from the internet eventually. But we'll never have any competition from the internet. Obviously, these companies get so big, the barriers to entry that are going to be made are going to be so high, the chances of starting on the internet becomes prohibitive. And finally, I mean, the media companies too, they, insofar as the internet becomes part of the media system, they have a much longer time horizon than any other rational capitalist would have. If you're a rational capitalist, you said, I'm going to go on the internet and try to set up a media company and compete with Disney and Time Warner, Probably after you lose a couple $100 million, you stop and say, well, do I want to drop another $200 million? This is a good idea. And if you're smart, you probably say no. That's what Microsoft did in 1998. It dropped a couple $100 million trying to be a media content player in the internet. Said, you know, we aren't getting anywhere here. We'll just buy those other companies or make deals with them, but we're not going to try to do it ourselves anymore. But the media companies are different. They know they cannot let the internet get away from them. That means they're going to have to stay there for however long it takes. They cannot allow that thing to be independent of them. And they'll stay there and keep losing money as long as it takes to keep it theirs. And they have to, because they're protecting $100 billion empires otherwise. If you don't have that $100 billion empire, that's a rational investment. You'll go somewhere else where you can make money rather than just flush it down that toilet. And that's exactly what's happening now among venture capitalists. My argument also is that the nature of our media system and the internet is not due to some free market. I mean, the mythology is that there's a bunch of heroic entrepreneurs duking it out, thousands of them at one time, and then they duke it out, and the more sufficient ones with the lowest prices and the best product win, and they're down to 100, and then they're duking it out. Then you're down to 50 big ones. They're duking it out, and you're down to 10. And the ones who win are the ones who should win. It's Darwinian. They give the people what they want. They're the deserved winners. If you don't like it, you should move to another country, or nowadays to another planet, soon to another solar system or galaxy. But that's nonsense. That's gibberish. Our media system today is not the result of some fair, balanced, level playing field of heroic entrepreneurs duking it out, giving the people what they want. In fact, our media system, the companies that dominate it to no small extent because they're the recipients of corporate welfare, of corporate monopoly franchises that made it virtually impossible not to be a winner. When the federal government gave free spectrum space to NBC, General Electric, in New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, Boston, and Detroit, and Philadelphia, basically they said, you win. They didn't say, now compete. They gave them monopoly rights to premier TV spectrum in those countries. A chimpanzee could make money managing that. They picked the winners. So then NBC can use the profits it makes from these monopolies they get from the government, these monopoly licenses, to go buy other stuff. That's what cable companies do. How do you think TCI, now which is bought by AT&T, or Time Warner, get so big, buy all this stuff? They have monopoly cable franchises. They're the only cable company somewhere. They make a ton of money. They use their monopoly profits from a government-sanctioned monopoly that no one else can do cable in their market, go out and buy film studios and book companies. So the government, our policies create the winners. That's done in our name, but without our informed consent. And my whole argument of the book is we've got to get our informed consent in on the process, because if it is in on the process, we'll have a very different looking media system than the one we currently do have. But of course, this issue is off limits in our politics, and that's a lot of what I write about. It's in this book as well. The mythology of the free market, the mythology that technologies will set us free. My favorite one that I write about a lot today, the mythology that the First Amendment was written to sort of keep these media giants from having any sort of responsibilities to the public. Sort of like, you know, Thomas Jefferson and Patrick Henry got together and said, you know, we got to have an amendment in the Constitution that protects really rich people to own all our media and no one can mess with them. Yeah, how can you have a democracy without that? In fact, I think even, I have no honest examination of the First Amendment that wouldn't argue that the sort of media system we have today, virtually 180 degrees away from the sort of media system envisioned by all the framers of the First Amendment, the debaters, the people who pushed it, Patrick Henry, Thomas Paine, Jefferson, even Madison, who was the least radical of that group. But the First Amendment has been increasingly turned into, at least in popular mythology, not yet entirely by the courts, fortunately, turned into trade legislation to protect the rights of these firms to do as they please without any obligations to the public, keeping their corporate welfare without any obligations to the public as well. So there are reasons why it's off limits as well, beyond this sort of first-rate propaganda that's served up and delivered so effectively. These are very powerful lobbies these media companies have in Washington. The Center for Public Integrity, an outstanding group in Washington, just did a big report on the corporate media lobbies, what they spend on lobbying, what they spend in campaign contributions to politicians. And their conclusion is they have so much power in Washington, it's unthinkable to challenge them by standard political methods, because they really just own the politicians. And it's not just a matter of having money. The corporate media have one other thing that no other commercial lobby has, which is they have control of the news media. And that's something that will get politicians' attention. if you know you own the news media and you have come in asking for a favor, they will notice that. And the general rule is you don't mess with these guys. That's why they tend to be a very powerful lobby. That doesn't mean the commercial media get everything they want, because they're going up against other powerful corporate lobbies too. It only means when they're going up against the general public, they get whatever they want. When they're going up against us, they win. But, when they're going up against the telephone companies and the computer companies, then you've got other massive lobbies duking it out. That's why they have to have these lobbying arsenals, not because of us, because they've been fighting the other corporations. And they are massive lobbying arsenals. The classic case of this recently was the Telecommunications Act of 1996, a law that is largely unknown to most Americans, but I think by any calculations, one of the four or five most important laws of the last 30 years. It's the law that basically was the last time Congress weighed in on how our media system, our communication system, internet, telephones, wireless, broadcast media, cable, how they should be structured, who they should serve, what the public interest was. And this was a law that basically had no public input. It was sort of this Olympics of superstar lobbyists duking it out from the telephone companies, long-distance companies, media companies, computer companies, all trying to get the best deal, the biggest slice of the pie. But they all agreed on one thing. They owned the system. It was their system. The public had no role in it. The whole fight was over who got the biggest slice of the pie. Sort of like the famous scene in Godfather 2, for those of you who've seen the old movies, where they're sitting on top of the building in Havana with a cake of Cuba, and all the mobsters are cutting up pieces of it. Who gets the biggest piece of Cuba? That's what the Telecommunications Act of 1996 was. It was a big cake that had like $10 trillion written in the frosting, and they were duking it out to who got the biggest slice of that cake. But it was made in our name without our informed consent. It included within some of the most reprehensible statutes in American history, which some of you, because I think it's a pretty sophisticated audience, are familiar with. One is the digital spectrum giveaway. Snuck into the bill in a highly corrupt manner, which I document in some detail, which basically said the commercial broadcasters are going to be given for free, with no obligation, $70 to $100 billion worth of spectrum to develop digital TV. Now, to understand how criminal this is, all the other people who use this scarce spectrum, the airwaves, like the cell phone companies, actually have to pay for it. These guys are getting it for free with no strings attached. It's all because they have this great lobby. And they snuck it in. It wasn't even debated at any time. This is major policy. Think of all the time they debate, Rush Limbaugh saw a welfare mom getting us a bag of potato chips and food stamps, and they blow steam on that for 2 months in Washington. But here you give away $100 billion. Oh, yeah, I missed that one. I went to the bathroom. It's extraordinarily corrupt. I think the corruption in media politics is seen, as I referred to earlier, in the Gore-Bush campaign this year. Both these candidates have terrible records on these issues. As I said, Bush is off the charts terrible. Gore is at the very bottom of the page, terrible. The number one corporate lobby to give money to the Gore campaign this year, commercial media, telecoms, and computers, by a wide margin. They own them. They also own Bush. They don't have to pay him as much. They already got him. He's dumb. Gore's smart. Gore's smart. He said, I'm going to sort of do a little rope-a-dope with these guys and jack out another $100 million. Bush said, I'll give you whatever you want. And I said, okay, we'll give you $10 million. Bush has got to learn how to play the game a little better to get more money out of these guys. But, it's a dreadful situation anyway, slice it with Gore and Bush. I mean, they're both basically paid for. There's no place in this debate for a public interest position. The range of debate is very narrow. It's over which corporations gets the best deal. It's not where the public fits in whatsoever. And so if you just look at issues like telecommunications and media, it's very hard to make any sort of credible case that Gore is a progressive candidate or a liberal candidate by traditional sense of that term. It's very hard to make the case he's anything but deplorable, as bad as Bush is. And Bush, I must say, indeed, is worse in that matter. My argument in the book, in the last chapter of the book, is that we need media reform. We have to structurally change the system. The problem with our media system and our communication system isn't that bad people run it. It isn't that, like, Rupert Murdoch's a bad guy, and if he would just go away and Fred Jones replaced him or Sally Smith, then everything would be fine. We have a better person running it, and we'll have better TV shows and better movies and a fuller range of opinions on that great Fox News channel. It's nothing to do with Rupert Murdoch or John Malone or Sumner Redstone or Jerry Levin. It's the system. If all those guys, the CEOs, were to go away, there were places to do more or less the exact same thing. They'd be getting the exact same cues. Some would do it better, some would do it worse. But, you know, they're very strong external pressures that guide what you do and don't do when you're running a corporation that's dedicated to the maximization of profit. So my argument is we have to change the system, change the structure. We can't let this much power be handled by so few people following these cues, which is just to maximize shareholder return, largely through serving advertisers and upscale consumers. And so much of the book, especially in the final chapter, talks about how we do that, what some of the proposed measures are. And I'll just mention a few of the things that are being worked on, I talk about in the book. And these things I don't think are that radical. I'm not calling for like the nationalization of newspapers and taking like media owners and getting through the street and stoning them with tomatoes. You know, it's nothing like that at all. I mean, I think it's stuff that even conservatives, much of this would approve of. Low-level conservatives, not the ideologues, but sort of street level. One, you know, we subsidize commercial media, as I said, our corporate media. The amount of corporate welfare these companies get is extraordinary. Why not subsidize the rest of us? Why not set up a strata of nonprofit, non-commercial media, local media that gets some sort of subsidy? It costs money to do good media. That's the truth. Just having a channel or a website doesn't amount to a hill of beans if you don't have the resources to do something with it. You know, it takes. I mean, even the indie media, you got to have a camera. You got to have this. It doesn't fall off a tree. So why not? There's a proposal an economist named Dean Baker made, and Jeff and Mark are familiar with it. Why not let every person take $200 off their taxes and give it to any nonprofit or non-commercial media of their choice? So either money can pay it to the government or you can give it to any nonprofit or non-commercial media. If we did that, we could have as much as $20, $30, $40 billion go to nonprofit and non-commercial media. It's a way of subsidizing it, but notice there's no commissar, no central committee, no Politburo that's going to decide where the money goes. You do. If you don't want to participate, you don't have to. But it would be a chance then for local communities to build up media. You know, someone could organize, get 1,000 people to give their $200 and build up local journalism in communities or national stuff, whatever you want. But that's one thing we could do. And I think we'll have legislation to that effect within a year and we can start organizing around it. And that's one thing conservatives should like. I mean, that's something anyone who wants an open marketplace of ideas, creative, that's something they should be able to get interested in. I mean, our hope is, and my belief is, that if at the bottom, where the great bulk of people are, when you expose them, they like the idea. No, and that's, you know, let me get something real clear that I should have said before. We're not going to win this fight at the top. This is the classic case of what Saul Alinsky, the organizer, said. If you're fighting organized money like we are here, you only win with organized people. And we need lots of people organized. And I'll even go farther. I'd say that you can't win this as a single issue. You organize as a single issue, but ultimately it's got to be part of a broader progressive platform. And then you can win. And it's going to be a long process. But, you know, I'm a lot more hopeful today than I was a year ago or 2 years ago. There's a lot has happened that's been very positive. Although I was a lot more hopeful 2 days ago than I am today. So it's sort of up and down, to be honest about everything. But there's other things, too. Public service broadcasting. Bill Moyers has helped start a group, Citizens for Independent Public Broadcasting, to give this country real public broadcasting. I mean, we've spent a pittance. We spent the same amount of public broadcasting in the United States that Japan or Britain spends. What would it be, like $10 billion a year? Roughly $10 billion a year. I asked Jeff because he knows so much. That's what I'm looking at. People are, who's this? $10 billion a year. For $10 billion a year, that's like more than the budget of any film studio or TV network. You could put a spectacular public broadcasting system in this country with local stations, public access, community, and national stuff. Great programming, creative, for that sort of money. And that's something, you know, people in this society were marinated in advertising. You know, we're carpet bombed with this stuff. To have a viable, totally non-commercial sector is something I think a lot of people would appreciate. I'm also a big fan of regulating commercial broadcasters. Regulation's gotten a bad name. People think, oh, regulation, that's bad. Well, it depends who's doing the regulation. We have regulation. The way it's regulated now is by corporations. I mean, they regulate what you see. It's not you pick. They regulate. You're going to see this or that. So I think when we give these people all the spectrum for free, we've got a right to say, okay, this is the deal. You've been getting this free ride for 70 years. You've made trillions of dollars. Now, if you want it, you're going to have to meet these standards. If you don't, you can give us the license back. We'll find someone else to do it, which is what you have to do if you're really going to be honest. There are a couple areas where I think regulation is most necessary. One is with political advertising on television. I think it should be outlawed. The condition of a broadcast license is no TV political ads. I mean, it used to be you'd have to make a long argument about how lame they are, how they're destroying our politics. Now it's almost self-evident. how lame they are, how they're destroying our politics. The cost of running a campaign is doubling every 8 years. It goes up 40 or 50%, and almost all the money goes to these idiotic political ads. My favorite story about political TV ads is there's a guy named Robert Spiro, who's the head of creative for Ogilvy & Mather Advertising Agency, which is one of the largest ad agencies in the world. And he was in charge of all their creative campaigns for, like, Palmolive soap and Budweiser. And he used to get so upset because he'd go to parties and people would be trashing political ads and say, it's just like those beer ads. And he said, hey, beer ads have some credibility. Give you a cut. You know, he was so upset. You know, how can you insult his craft? So he took a year off from his job and did a content analysis of every TV political ad in presidential race from 1952 to, I think, 1980. And he said if any of those was held to the same standards his ads had to meet then at the FTC, they'd all be found fraudulent, every single one. Let's tell the truth. They're total crap. I mean, they're an insult to your intelligence as a human being that they exist. And they cost a fortune. They cost a fortune. When you look where the money comes for these ads increasingly. Oh, here's an example. Ralph Nader's campaign, much beloved apparently from New York, raised all of $6 million. $6 million in his campaign. In my home state of Wisconsin, both Gore and Bush each spent more than $6 million just in TV ads in that state, a state of 4.5 million people. That's Nader's entire budget. My wife's Norwegian. Norwegian correspondent for their equivalent of the PBS or BBC, who's over here, covers the political race. She said that George Bush in one day spent more, this is during the primaries, spent more than the Labour Party, the largest party in Norway, spends on an entire election for the entire parliament. One day of George W. Bush. And where does this money come from? Well, we don't know much about those shadowy soft money groups because the reporting requirements are so lax, but we do know about the individual requirements where you actually keep pretty tight records. If you ever give money, you know. And what we know is that 90% of the money in individual campaign contributions come from the wealthiest 0.25% of Americans. Well, gee whiz, I wonder why WTO isn't being debated. I mean, you get exactly the sort of political culture you would expect when the wealthiest 0.25% of Americans are bankrolling these moronic ads so candidates can compete. And if you don't run those ads, you don't get taken seriously as a candidate. You don't get coverage on the media. And now our print journalism increasingly tails the ads now as the new stories. Oh, what did candidate A say about candidate B's ad last week? And what's B going to do about A's response to B's ad? The ads are running it. They're the currency now of our political culture. So let's get rid of those ads right away. Of course, that will meet a certain amount of opposition from the National Association of Broadcasters and Corporate Media, which is the number one lobby that opposes campaign finance reform. Get this. They get the airwaves for free, make piles of dough, then they sell these insulting ads, make piles of dough. They don't do any journalism on candidates anymore. The amount of journalism on these stations has plummeted. Why should they give it away when they can get people to pay for it? And then they hire these big lobbies in Washington to make sure that the system stays exactly as it is and there's no campaign finance reform. It's an extraordinarily corrupt system. Very sleazy. It's got to change. Let's get a law prohibiting campaign ads as a condition of broadcast license and organize around it. And I tell you, I floated that one before Republicans. And they like it. And once you get down below the top level, once again, you get real people in Iowa or even New York, Brooklyn, anywhere, no one likes those ads. They're an insult to everyone's intelligence. The only people who like them are the ones who benefit by it directly, who have a money stake in it. There are other things, too. I won't go into detail because I think I'm already going, I'm like halfway through my list and I think I've already overshot my time. But some of the other things are setting real ownership restrictions on companies. We have way too much concentrated ownership. This doesn't mean just applying antitrust to deal after deal, but really having a discussion to set what would proper ownership be across the board and putting those requirements in and keeping it there. The problem with antitrust is that once one deal gets in, it sets the standard. You can't justifiably stop anyone else. Once AOL Time Warner cuts its deal, how can you tell Yahoo not to make the deal with Disney? You can't. It's not fair to them. How can they compete with AOL Time Warner? Then AOL Time Warner adds something else. It's a no-win situation. The only way to do it is have coherent ownership restrictions, requirements that apply across the board that are set, that apply to everyone equally. The problem with our media system is there's only so many people producing it. So I want media reforms that expand who's producing it. So it's not just those same 20 companies. And it's just a way of corporate welfare in its worst forms. This means you're pumping another $10 billion into their bank accounts. And it's not just advertisers that are the problem. I mean, it's this is the commercial system in total. So it might reduce the influence of advertisers, but I doubt it. It would just mean more money for them. They keep doing the same thing. What you want to do, why that subsidy plan I think is better, is create new providers, new people making content, not just the same people making, giving them more money and hoping they put less ads in it. That'd be my advice. But I'd have to read I'd love to read a mapped out, you know, a real proposal on it and consider it, 'cause that's just my knee-jerk reaction. You know, being a professor, I like to just say whatever comes to my mind, and what the hell, I've got tenure. There's other stuff, too, we could do, but as I just close on a couple things. This has got to be part of a progressive movement. It can't be a single issue, but it's going to be organized on a single issue level. And, you know, ironically, I think the political left in this country has to do it, but it's not really a left-right issue. I mean, I just want to emphasize this. I do lots of talks that aren't to the choir. I do lots of talks to, like, religious groups and, you know, Kiwanis clubs and, you know, people who aren't voting for Nader, who don't read The Nation, who don't know anything about that stuff. They haven't even heard of Nader sometimes. And they're really concerned about what's going on, the commercial carpet bombing of their children, which I haven't spoken about much here, but it's one of the big themes in my work. They're concerned about the lousy journalism. They're concerned about the TV ads. They're very open to things to change this media system. And once you get below, like, the talking classes, the talking heads, the punditry, which, you know, is so lame in our culture, you know, just as an aside, I mean, I think you can make an argument that the talking heads, like you get on Fox News Channel, with the exception of one person I can think of, and MSNBC, Chris Matthews and Geraldo, the sort of commentary you get in politics in these shows is entirely compatible with a totalitarian society. I mean, I think you could have had two people... Like they had a year of, like, Giuliani versus Hillary on national TV, and be like, oh, her butt's too big. Oh, well, he snarls too much. I mean, you could have that in, you know, Kosygin versus Brezhnev. Yeah, Brezhnev, man, he got bad eyelashes. Yeah, man, the big butt. I mean, that's not democracy. That's crap. And so the punditry class will oppose this. Yeah, the punditry class but. When you get below that radar to the actual heart of the people, I think there's people never hear about this stuff. When people hear about this, no one throws anything at me. No one yells. They say, yeah, that's really interesting. Why haven't I heard about this? What can we do about it? What can we do to reduce commercialism? What can we do to improve the quality of journalism? I'm very optimistic, but I don't think liberals and conservatives can lead this fight. I think liberalism and conservatism have both become entirely bankrupt in our political culture. Liberalism is actually a wonderful, rich historical tradition. It's not flawless. It's a strong elitist strain. But if you look at people like John Dewey or John Stuart Mill, the conviction that society should make it so everyone can benefit and develop their skills and talents to the best of their ability, that's a wonderful idea. I mean, I'm a liberal in that sense. But the problem with liberalism, when it comes into conflict with corporate power and big money, it sort of has to make some tough decisions. Liberalism in our culture, and Al Gore, I think, personifies this, has basically said, okay, we'll throw out the liberal jazz. We'll suck up the money, and then we'll just grab some sound bites, you know, get some votes. But it's lost its guts. Gutty liberalism was willing to go against entrenched money power to stand up for liberal values. We don't have gutty liberalism in this society. We have a few decent people. But for the most part, they sort of make their peace with the status quo. They're unwilling to challenge entrenched economic power in any meaningful sense. Conservatism has been, I mean, if I was a genuine conservative in this country, there aren't many left, I would like to do a class action suit against Milton Friedman and Pat Buchanan and all these morons who have turned conservatism into this cesspool of, you know, mendacity. You've got, you know, conservatism once meant, I mean, in the 1930s, prominent conservatives wrote a book criticizing the New Deal, talking about how you had to decentralize society, talking about how concentrated wealth was also a problem for a free society. Conservative critique of the New Deal. Today, the suck-up demand movement as such among conservatives is unthinkable to hear George Will or Rush Limbaugh criticize concentrated wealth. Unthinkable. They couldn't do it. That's how they define conservatives, defined by your obedience to the needs of the wealthiest people. Well, in criticism of that is defined as non-conservatism. They've turned it into this unbelievably crude, grotesque political philosophy. But people who are rank and file conservatives don't think that way. That's this talking class. I mean, you actually get out to someone who's voting for Bush in Oklahoma, they actually think conservatives, that old stuff about, you know, fair government that's not corrupt and not hassling people, not the real deal that they actually the conservatism is being generated. Or another part of conservatism, a great part of the conservative tradition was its hostility to empire. You know, it was actually opposed to the United States telling other governments what to do for a long time. Now, there's a great conservative historian named Chalmers Johnson from the University of California at San Diego, wrote a book some of you are probably familiar with, critical of U.S. domination of the world today and how negative it is for the entire planet, ultimately, to have an imperial system. That's an unthinkable book for an American conservative to write, so wed to the notion that we have this 007 right to invade any country we want for any reason. The idea, and so wed to militarism as a way of life, sort of sucking on the nipple of the military-industrial complex as the natural way of life. So these people are useless. The mainstream liberals, conservatives, they're not going to be helped. The talking heads class, the elites of these movements. But I think the rank and file, the ideas of media reform, and actually progressive politics, have a lot of hope across what's considered the political spectrum. I don't think it's something that can be just marginalized and put off to a small sect of people on college campuses, as the traditional pundits like to regard it. So I'll stop at that and take some questions. Thank you all very much.